We began lunch, that I would take some questions. So, I'm ready. Questions about the practice, this morning's practice, what I was saying, your outside of this retreat meditation, please. Okay, then you can teach the retreat. No. I'll give you another few moments, because if you have even a slight little question, you can be sure someone else wants to know the answer to.
I have a question.
Hi.
After the retreat on Salt Spring, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think just to deal with the stimulation of coming back into the city, I got really quite OCD. I was like really involved in finding the best eco dish rack you could possibly find. Like, I just, you know, it was like my mind was just getting really contracted to, I think, deal with the spaciousness that happened.
And so, advice?
What's that?
You're asking for advice.
Well, just practice suggestions. I kind of figured things.
There is a phenomenon that we call it in the meditation lingo, yogi mind. And when you take intensive retreat, you're called a yogi. I mean, it's just using a translation from the Pali language that the Buddha uses about meditators. I used to think it was yogi bear, and it was all rather hippie-ish and weird, but it actually is straight from the Pali, so got used to it. Anyway, so yogi mind means the kind of mind which I think you're describing, which can happen to people when you get really deeply concentrated, is whatever it is that's in your awareness is paramount, and you kind of lose perspective is basically what it is. So that you, something bothers you, it can really bother you. I remember having yogi mind on a retreat, and it was a long retreat. It was like, I don't know how many weeks, it was several months kind of retreat, and two things happened. And it was at IMS, which is the place in Massachusetts, the big center some of you know about, and that's sort of at the end of Tornado Alley up there, and which, of course, I'm from the West Coast, so I don't really have experience in, but so it was at the lag end of some kind of big system, weather system. But what happened was electrical storms were happening. And I've always wore skirts a lot. I've always worn since I was a hippie. And so what happened is my slip completely attached itself to my legs. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to have that other slip, which is in the third drawer down behind this and this and this at home. And so I had to write to my partner with this panic. He had to go rifling through my underwear drawer to find this particular slip and send it. And I wrote to him, and he had to send it express, because I was really worried about my skirts sucking up onto my, having to walk around with skirts sticking to my legs. I was like, I got so, and then later on in the same retreat, it was the same person in the same scenario, I didn't have, and this is, you can tell, long ago, I didn't have my passport. I'd only brought my driver's license, and it had been okay to go on this, but I wasn't sure if I'd be able to get back okay on just a driver's license. It was before it was mandatory to have a passport. But I got really panicked about not being able to get home. And so I again wrote this rather desperate letter. And he wrote back saying, I'm not quite sure if it's actually a problem or you think it's a problem. But anyway, it was the same. It was just that the state of, you just get so obsessed about your particular issue when you lose perspective, where there's no one to talk to and there's no one to bounce anything back off, and it can get distorted. And then you're sort of hyper about that thing. This eco dish racks. I don't know if that's what...
Well, this was after the retreat, so it's like I was really expanded, and then just, I think, to manage being all the sensory stuff.
Oh, it was more like a sensory overload.
Right? It's like just the mind really contracting and getting, it's like the way to have, it's like this can't...
How to go from here to here.
This can't really stay.
No, well, it won't stay. I mean, a big, open, spacious mind will not last when you have to deal with the day-to-day reality.
And it was quite dramatic. Like, it was, like, quite a dramatic closing down. Like, okay, I'm just going to focus on this because then I can feel...
Well, the only thing we do, to knowing that people are very expanded from quiet of retreat, and not just expanded, but very sensitive, with no kind of, none of the, not none of, but layers and layers of our armor has sort of melted because we haven't needed it. And so there's a vulnerability and a great sensitivity and a tenderness and also a slowness that all grows in retreat environments. And so we tend to encourage people to take several days to integrate kind of thing and to take plenty of time in solitude and quietly, to do it slowly. And sometimes on the long retreats that we take several days of the process. I remember one teacher saying to people, this is a 2 month long retreat. And I was one of the teachers, and he said to the students, this particular day, we want you all who have got cars here in the car park to go down and get in your car. And then the next day you get in your car and you turn the engine on for 10 minutes. And then the next day, you know, sort of to gradually let people rev up, as it were, and get used to more noise. And I remember going into the office, for instance, after two or three months long retreats, and asking them if I could do stuff in the office just so that I could hear them talking on the phone, and you know, or I'd start talking to people on the road when I'd like to practice in this country environment in England. And so I would choose to then start engaging. I'd meet somebody on the road and I'd start chatting to them because I wanted to be more normal and, you know, be less sort of precious, if you like, you know, floaty, because it's a process, because it's weird to do that, to set that self up in a retreat. It's an unusual thing for most of our lives, and so you have to do that with some, manage it with care is all I would say, and give yourself some time and not take it personally. That's the main thing. It's just that the system gets very sensitized and open. Yeah. We used not to, you know, in the early days when it was early being taught in North America, Westerners, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, no one mentioned this kind of thing. And you'd go straight out of a retreat and you'd walk straight into lampposts and you have to get in a car. And no one actually warned you about you needed to integrate yourself slowly. You know, it's learned over time. So I don't know if that's useful. No, not one suggestion. I mean, there's so many different aspects to meditating. And there are so many different foci for meditation. And some are more subtle, and some are more open, and some are more specific, and some are more one-pointed. And there are different techniques, there are different traditions, there are different approaches, and there's you and your particular mind and your particular life and what's been going on in your history, the way you're wired. And so it's hard to answer. It's too vague to be able to answer because it would take too much specific information, I would say. No one that pops into my mind. Sorry. Hi, Priscilla.
Can you speak about the neural pathways and how you change the destination of your brain?
Destination, I don't know about destinations, but pathways to no destination in particular. You know, I get images in my mind because I'm so visual. Was one that I got long before we all knew about the science of the brain, which was the Buddha's words, and he talked about there being this old abandoned city in the woods all overgrown, and us walking along and then realizing that there's a city in there, no people, but nevertheless, and being interested and then going towards it and walking there and finding there's this whole part of your life you never even knew existed. The whole understanding part of your brain that you had never accessed before. But by going there one time, you can go there more easily again the next time because you're now beating a little pathway there. And so it's like just by stepping through the woods in some way, you'll find that there are footprints and then you can go and you can go and you start being able to go more easily. And it's sort of, that's a description of what goes on in the brain with neurocircuitry. And when something links up with something and something else, it will relink much more easily, and those links grow until there's whole threads. And so, but we've got some really deep grooves from childhood about I am separate and I like chocolate and I don't like that kind of thing, and you know, I need that and this is wrong, and they're very deep opinions we have, you know, desires that we have, fears that we have, they're so deeply established, and which are reinforced by our lifestyle and by our culture and by our history and by our advertising or whatever. And by we hang out with people who reinforce it, because that's why we like those people, because we all say yes, yes to the same, whatever it is, political view and stuff. And so in meditation, we're actually switching from those grooves and growing little tiny new ones. But the thing to remember about it is the more frequently we tread that pathway, the more it gets established. And the more infrequently, or the more we keep breaking from something, then it just isn't exactly wither, but it just doesn't get so deeply established. And so it's not just recognizing something, understanding something, thinking something, it's being that way. So like understanding, say, gratitude is a good thing. So thinking for a few minutes about being grateful and even feeling grateful and then going back to bitching, you know, that's not going to work so well as if you can maintain that attitude of fulfilledness, you know, appreciation for this and this and this and this. It's not about the thing which is going to keep changing. The weather's going to change and the sun's going to change and your feelings of your, you know, your physical well-being is going to change. But if that attitude becomes more established, then it gets much more powerful. So that's why I was saying, I think you're referring to when I said continuity. You know, when you can keep being embodied, for instance, not just, oh yes, I'm good at being in my body at dance class and then the rest of the time I'm off in my head. When it breaks up, it doesn't get that establishment. Another word that the Buddha used, that we have used in the English language to translate the foundations of mindfulness, is the establishments of mindfulness. And I like that word, because when it's established, when something's established, like a plant, I'm a gardener, you know, it's not going to fall over at the first drought or the first wind or first brush of something. It's actually got some strength and is stable there. And we want to become established in mindfulness, in gratitude, in being embodied, in being present, you know, in being interested, those things. So we learn them as techniques, for instance, or we hear these teachings or read something, but then we need to apply it on a much more steady basis for it to become, you know, a new pathway of the nerves running, linking up. Yeah.
So I go on the cushion, but it's almost like my mind wants to stay.
Yeah, go round and round and round. Yeah. Because that's because that link you've been establishing, because you've been going around and around doing that thing. So that's takes more effort to switch, and it'll easily go back to that, and a little trigger, and it'll be back in that circuit again. So you can see it working inside yourself. And the reason we meditate, actually, I mean, in time, meditation becomes just the normal way of being, you know, being present, being aware, being open. But while training, because the mind wants to go off and not do that, then we bring it back and we give it attention, and we do it in retreat because we're less likely in the silence and this calm, and it usually is beauty, to have to be triggered into that activity. It still will happen internally, but when we're giving ourselves these other ways of doing it, that's why we do retreats in the first place. Why we do the weird thing of being silent, it actually will help these new pathways. Because as soon as you speak to somebody and they sound like that person, then back you are in your old circuit. And some people, that's true, and some people's vice versa. Everything's fine, and they're just not, who needs meditation? As soon as they're in trouble, they go, hit the cushion, help. So, you know, there's no one thing of it. But when life is besetting us, we're so busy coping with it that we maybe think of meditation as a luxury, and I can only get there when I've got enough space for it, or something like that. That kind of thinking we can have too. So, yeah, everyone's relationship to their meditation practice will be slightly different. If you had a conversation in a group of people, there would be a whole variety in there. I think a response to that is one of the one of the major benefits of having regularity with anything like cleaning your teeth or whatever it is, washing your hands before a meal, is that then it's much more likely to be available, even when times are easy or when times are tough or whenever it is for you that it would otherwise get sabotaged. So again, establishment, you know, bedtime, things like that. I have a grandson, so bedtime's one of those things we're establishing, you know, so it's reliable because we need it. So. Hello.
Hi. I found that this is partly a question, but it's more of a comment first. When we were doing the gratitude practice, I found that I was doing it by rote. There was no feeling connection at that moment, and I know in my past I felt it. Mm-hmm. So I listed everybody that I would feel grateful for and everybody that I could think of, situations, being born, everything. Went out for my walking meditation, sort of nothing. There was still some pain in the body, and there's still a bit of pain in the body. But when I left for lunch, I saw the winter roses. How beautiful. So there was a shift in me that I didn't realize was happening. And I can do that through prayer, mm-hmm. but I didn't realize that gratitude was
going to be. Well, thank you for sharing that. Did everybody hear? Yeah. Okay. Meditation isn't a production. It's not to try and make something happen. You know, it's an invitation and it's an inclination, and even though you weren't feeling anything, you weren't planning to rob a bank, you weren't arguing with your neighbor at the time, you were calling up people who mean something to you and appreciating them as best you could. Now, whether or not, you know, it was fired up with a matching emotional sensitivity or wasn't, that just was not in your control. But do it anyway. You know, it's because the very act of directing attention, choosing to direct attention instead of being at the mercy of what your mind feels like thinking about at the moment, is meditation, some form of training. And that's very useful. So I like to say there are different forms of meditation. There's concentration meditation, there's awareness meditation, there's narrow, sort of, some things wider, there's emotional types of meditation, there's sound meditation, there's so many, you know. There's contemplation for sure, there's prayer for sure. This reminds me of a little thing that apparently Mother Teresa said. Somebody asked Mother Teresa, when you pray, what do you actually say? And she says, nothing. I just listen. And then they said, and what does God say then? And she says, nothing, I just listen. And if you don't understand that, I can't explain it. But then other people will have different things. They'll speak in prayer. They'll be talking to, you know, a wise being, or they're, you know, requesting is oftentimes. Anyway, it's what a different, you know. Yeah, I think of counting blessings as praying and a form of praying. Hi. And which?
Vipassana.
Vipassana and?
And what we're doing now.
What we're doing now. Oh, sure. So Vipassana, the word is basically commonly translated as insight, seeing inside, seeing what's happening inside. And so it's in the more sort of classic ways, it's one of two, the Buddha called two wings of a bird. And one is shamatha practice and one is vipassana. And shamatha practice means concentration practice, calming practice, where the mind is basically not allowed to run all over the place, but is trained to focus somewhere in particular. And that can shift and change, but that you can use different things on which to occupy the attention, but it's the settling down of the attention rather than allowing thinking and discursive activity to go on in the mind. And that's usually considered necessary first. Vipassana isn't controlling the thinking process so much as, instead of, it's like there are two, this really helps me, two parts of our brain going on at the same time. There's the thinking about things part, left hemisphere, commentary, liking, not liking, scheming, how to get more of, less of, that busy part. And then behind that, sitting in the background, sitting in the audience in a way, is a sort of an overview awareness that is observing what's going on and knowing and understanding. We call that mindfulness. Mindful awareness, present awareness, different names. With Vipassana, what we want to do is be able to allow our lives to occur as they do, sensory input to come as it will, without excluding anything, which this is, shamatha practice is excluding. No, you're quiet, you're going to just pay attention to your nose or your abdomen rising and falling or the tingling in your hands or whatever you've chosen as a as an object to help you settle. And you're not observing the comings and goings of the variety of life. But Vipassana, this is sort of extremely one and extremely the other, allows for the comings and goings of anything and everything into your awareness, in through your mind, while knowing that's what's happening and not being caught in the usual, I like this and I don't like that, ooh, that's better, kind of thinking. Staying in the sort of background awareness. Sounds fine. And so it's like simply observing your attitude of once observing the attitude and that front part of your brain, not giving way to it when it compulsively chases after the pleasant and gets resistant to the unpleasant and tunes out all of the everything in between, which is what it does with no training. And so to do that takes a certain stabilizing to access and become established in, as I was talking to Priscilla, in this awareness part of the mind, which needs to be functioning during Vipassana. So to access that and to establish that, we do shamatha practice first, basically. What I'm teaching here is how to begin to get to shamatha practice, which is through relaxing, because shamatha practice is calming. But to calm the mind, you can use the mind to calm the mind, but it's kind of like you're using an infant or an infantile mind, a mind which is disturbed, distressed, confused, bound up, entangled, to help itself. And it's not able to help itself very well because it's all in confused, entangled, and bound up. And I'm doing this with my hands because my image is trying to sew with boxing gloves on, which is really tricky to do, and that's all you have. So I'm trying to find a couple of other ways to help calm the mind down so it can do more concentration. And one of the most useful ways is tell it to relax and help the body relax, because it affects the inner state, as you've seen, and to be grateful, because that affects the inner state, as you've seen. So there's some Vipassana going on when you are able to see that when I'm grateful, and I remember my grandmother, not my grandmother, I don't like that grandmother, but when a lot of us have benign grandmother, I'm a grandmother right now, I'm hoping my grandson can say this. It actually gives a sense of reassurance and calm. So I can see that that is useful, and so I will do that. In your case, it wasn't that useful for a while until the Lenten roses actually really did it for you, and they calmed you right down, and that was lovely, so that your state is then more able to be available to do Vipassana. But to teach Vipassana right off the bat, especially if there are people, and a lot of people hadn't met me before, so I don't know your practice, to suggest we start with Vipassana, it's very hard to allow multi-sensory input and maintain awareness of it without getting sucked into this is nice, this is not nice, I like, I don't like, I get resistant. So it's unskillful to attempt Vipassana without a certain calming. How's that? So this is part of the... And because it's a two-day retreat, as I said this morning, I like to emphasize calming the first day and Vipassana the second, rather than access straight into... But that's not how lots of people teach. People teach differently. One of my teachers was Sayadaw Tejaniya. I went to his monastery in Burma, and he teaches Vipassana, and he said, if concentration is worth a dollar, Vipassana is worth 10,000. Okay. And the Buddha said... dollar each. And I'm actually with the Buddha. But that's the way it works for him. And so he teaches what works for him. And there are other people who, like one teacher, Asian teacher, Bhante Gunaratana, who teaches in West Virginia, he's Sri Lankan, he said to Westerners years ago, and only to somebody who told this to me, I've never met him one-on-one. I've seen him in meditation centers and stuff, but not had a private interview with him. He says that if people want to come and do serious study with him and his monastery, Westerners, then they must do 3 years of metta before he'll teach them even concentration, because they absolutely need to like themselves first, because it's pointless, because you're just sitting there down on yourself. And he says, I can't even begin to teach them concentration until they've had 3 years of metta. So that's his style. So, you know, we're all different. Teachings is different styles. One more. Hi.
Well, I'll just kind of follow up on that.
So yeah.
When you're just meditating, how important is it that you really follow a style, or how long does it take before you kind of click on to, oh, that's that?
It takes a time. It takes a while, which is one of the reasons why. And certainly in my experience, I didn't have any meditation teachings except on retreat, because there weren't any anywhere. And so I began in the 80s. In 81 was when I first went to. This is Buddhist meditation. I had done some Hindu devotional, actually not Hindu, but Sikh devotional, in the 70s when I was in my 20s. And so I was repeating several syllables, which were holy names apparently, but they weren't holy to me. They were in a different language, but I was repeating these da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then I was trying to visualize a light in my third eye, which I failed to visualize, but I was trying. And so for about 4 years, I was doing 2.5 hours a day of that. But, you know, not very successfully, but I was learning how to sit. And then at 81, I began meditation this style, Vipassana style. But it was not, there weren't books around, there weren't audio talks, there weren't classes, there weren't groups of people. And so I just would go and do 10-day retreats. And so it was on the retreats, over years of going on retreats, because you hear something and you put it into practice and you can do it. But they were intensive retreats, and so that's how I learned. And increasingly now it's so available, you can read a million wonderful books and you can hear talks, and you can practice in all different kinds of ways. And as I just finished saying, there's so many different approaches and different teachers with different styles. And so it's, you know, it's lovely to have choice, but it's like going to a restaurant with like 10 pages of multiple choice. You don't know what to choose, you know. So it takes a while to learn what works for you, what styles you like, which of the different techniques. So it takes a little while to realize that they're all actually the same. They're all leading in the same place, and they're not that drastically different from each other. And they all start making sense. They all start hanging together. But yeah, just keep going and try. My first teacher, Goenka, the first Vipassana teacher, his instruction was, if you're looking for water in your digging a well, looking for water in your back garden. You know, if you dig 2 feet down and there's no water, and you dig 2 feet down and there's no water, and you dig 2 feet down and there's no water, you can dig 22 feet and no water, you're never going to find water because it's actually 20 feet down. So you've got to take a place and just go for it and see if, you know, keep going until you hit the water, you know. So don't do a million different kinds of styles and things, because you'll be a dilettante, you know, a master of none. But at the same time, it's nice to find teachers with a style that makes sense to you, and you can engage with that. And you think that feels right, and that feels familiar, and that makes sense. And then take that on, and then practice that for a while. So sort of a little of the both, I would suggest, because they're not, you know, they're all the same, but they're all slightly the way is slightly different. The methods make a slight difference to different people. So. It's nice to have different approaches. In my experience, what has happened in both myself and students of mine, for a while you'll come together with a certain teacher and you'll listen to that way of explaining things. It'll make sense to your mind, like language or whatever it is. And so you study with that person, you go to several retreats, so you read their books and listen to their talks, and you avail yourself of those teachings for a time. And then you hear another one or a different one, and then you pursue that one for a while. And that's what I've experienced too. So that you're using the style of a teacher to help you deepen into something. But it doesn't mean that that's the only way, but that works for a while. That's really, I think, probably the most useful. Does that help you? Whatever. It's all good. It all leads in the same direction anyway. Okay.